the spices, please consider extra water. Please don't get dehydrated. Above all, please learn to breathe slowly, breathe out slowly. Listen, watch those videos, Ali, Tycho, T-Y-C-H-O, and the word breathing. It will take you to those three videos. So we need to breathe slow. We need to speak softly. We need to rid our anger and rage. We need to learn to how to become a nobody. You know, I think that this one sentence that I want to be a nobody, and recognizing that it would be a lot tougher for you if you have not had the illusion that you are a somebody. And so, yes, it is tougher if you don't have the illusion that you are somebody. It's easier if you have the illusion that you are somebody, that someday you can become a nobody. But what a wonderful way to normalize your blood pressure in pursuit of being a nobody. This has been Science, Health, and Healing, and I'm your host, Majid Ali. Please visit me on those websites that I mentioned. We provide a lot of free information. Until next Wednesday, may you be gracious, graceful, and generous in your spirit. Good night.
Barbara Gleickstein. Diana Mason and I co-host Health Styles. Here's my ask. Please become a BAI buddy. It's only 33 cents a day, and that math equals $10 a month, and you're going to be supporting your station. Why don't you become one of us? Become that activist global citizen making a difference in the world every day, and just for 33 cents. We've been around for quite a while here at WBAI, and we think this is an awesome new idea. So please join us and become a BAI buddy. Go to WBAI.org and sign up. And thank you.
And just about midnight, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. Coming up at 1:30, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. But right now, it is midnight, and it is time for another commemorative broadcast of Earthwatch with Robert Knight.
Today's historical edition of Earthwatch goes back to the year 2000. The late Robert Knight interviews Carey Mullis, who received a Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1993 for his invention for the polymerase chain reaction, PCR. The process, which Carey conceptualized in 1983, is hailed as one of the monumental scientific techniques of the 20th century. His autobiography, Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, was published in 1998. In this interview, Mullis challenges the conventional view that connects AIDS to the HIV virus and speaks about the age of nutritional obsession. Robert ends the program with a commentary on the police, Rudy Giuliani, and the Million Youth March.
month, and welcome to Earth Watch here on WBAI New York. I'm Robert Knight. We have a very special interview tonight with the winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the invention of the polymerase chain reaction, the PCR DNA test, which has revolutionized the world of biology and of our everyday life. We'll be speaking with him exclusively. And perhaps later on we might have a few thoughts about the Miliani March. But I invite you to tune in tomorrow, Thursday afternoon, between 3 and 5 o'clock, when I will be hosting Talk Back in the place of Eutrice Lead. And it's been a very busy few days since Saturday, September 5th. Thank goodness for coffee and guarana, because last night there were pressing developments in Brooklyn in the aftermath of the march. There were, I'm busy compiling an audio documentary of some interesting moments of the day. And I expect you might be hearing some of that tomorrow. And in the meantime, prepare to be astonished by an extraordinarily brilliant mind with our guest tonight, Dr. Carrie Mullis. Carrie Mullis. He is the winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. He is also the inventor of a most utilitarian process. It is the polymerase chain reaction DNA test. We have heard so much about that in recent times. What is your invention and what is its importance?
Well, PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction. Most people have heard it as PCR. It's a method by which one can look at, or focus on is a better word for it, focus on a particular sequence of DNA. And a particular sequence of DNA means, like, say, 250 or 300 base pairs out of 3 billion. And what a base pair is one of the letters in the DNA code, of which there are about 3 billion in every human being's cells. And every one of us has a unique sequence, unless maybe we're identical twins, and then we might have exactly the same sequence. But of the 3 billion bases, everybody really has a unique sequence. And some of those sequences, some of the uniqueness, and some of the what they call polymorphisms, meaning like slight differences, some of them don't mean anything much, or at least it seems that they don't. They're two letters that sort of stand for the same thing in the context that they're in. Others of them can be very serious. Like if you have a single base change in the hemoglobin gene at what's called codon 39, I think. It might be 38, somewhere around there. If you have a single change from an A to a T, you can get a disease called sickle cell anemia, which is crippling and very, very painful. Muscular dystrophy is caused by the lack of a certain sequence, like some 100,000 base pairs sometimes is just omitted, and then you end up with muscular dystrophy. Cystic fibrosis is caused by something similar. There's a lot of changes in your DNA that are harmless to you and that just identify you from other people. They're not there with the intent of identifying you from other people. They just happen that way. But some changes can be devastating. And PCR is able to identify those changes. And so in some contexts, it's used to try to find out if a fetus is going to be born okay, or if it's going to be born with something like muscular dystrophy, in which case you might think that you want to abort it. Maybe you decide not to, but at least with PCR you can find out really early. Same thing applies to 600 or 700 genetic diseases where you, if you have some suspicion or some reason to think that your child might in fact be suffering from one of those while it's in utero, then you can find out with PCR. You can do a lot of more spectacular things than that, but that was the first real uses of PCR. And it, what it is, it's sort of, if you think of the DNA of a human being as being all the letters in about 600 volumes that are 1,000 pages long. Or you could think of it as 1,000 volumes that are 600 pages long, but they have little teeny letters in there. That's what 3 billion base pairs looks like in letters. That'd be little A's and T's and C's and G's. Now, to read such a thing, if it were all arranged in a nice library in order with page numbers and stuff, it's possible if it's books. If you wanted to find out if there was a mistake, for instance, in the spelling of a particular word in a particular paragraph in one of your 600,000-page books, with a little effort, you could figure that out. But if somebody came in your house while you were out of town and ripped all the pages out of all of those books and tore them into tiny shreds and threw them on the floor of your living room, which would fill the living room up, and then you wanted to figure it out, be a lot harder. And that's what happens when you take a bunch of cells and you put them in a grinder or something to get the DNA out of them and try to find the DNA sequence that you might be interested in. And it seemed like an almost impossible task for a long time once it was realized just how complex the DNA was. But then around 1975, people figured out how to take a tiny little piece of DNA, put it into a bacteria, and get the bacteria to make lots of copies of it. Well, that was called cloning, and that helped. And there, with that process, sometimes in 2 years, sometimes in 6 months, depending on how frequent the particular sequence was that you were looking for, how rare it was, you could do that. You could make a lot of copies of it. What PCR did was make it possible to do that in about 2 or 3 hours. Knowing the sequence that you're looking for, you can define it the same way that you do with like a word processor when you say, find Bartholomew, or find Jesse Bartholomew, and look on the hard disk anywhere you want to and find it, and go to that spot. PCR does that to DNA. As any sample of DNA that you have, you do the find command by making these two little pieces of DNA that have the particular sequence you're searching for on it, or they have the edges of it, and then the whole sequence between those two comes up in multiple copies, millions or billions of copies, as many as you want, basically, and then you can physically just reach into the tube and grab out a sample and read the DNA sequence. That's what, in one way, it does. It does a lot more. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing that most people get excited about.
You had to not only work out the search command, but the chain reaction part of the name implies to me that you also had to left shift the number of molecules. You had to increasingly double them, did you not?
Right. Well, the process works in such a way that it every you do something, and it's very simple what you do. You basically, it isn't very simple what you do, but it looks simple from the outside. What you do is you take a tube, a little tube that has a drop of water in it, and in that drop of water there are probably 50 or 60 different reagents, and also the sample of DNA that you want to examine, and you heat it and you cool it, and you heat it up to about boiling, and then back down to about 75 degrees centigrade, which is, I don't know, about 190 Fahrenheit. You go back and forth and back and forth. Every time you do it, it doubles the amount of the sequence of interest, so that you start off with one, you get two, then four, then eight, then 16, then 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, 2048, and so forth, until after 30 cycles of that sort of thing, you have a billion. And with a billion copies of a single DNA sequence, in the presence of a genome, like the human genome, which only had 3 billion base pairs in it in the first place, if you have a billion copies of something that's got 200 base pairs in it, most of the DNA in the tube is now the part that you wanted to look at. It allows you to focus on a particular part of the DNA sequence in the same way that a tuner, for instance, on a radio allows you to tune in one station out of maybe 1,000 that might be in reach of your receiver. And then the volume control is how many cycles you do.
One of the things that thrilled me in your description in Dancing Naked in the Minefield is that you rebelled against Avogadro's number.
Oh, I wouldn't say I rebelled against it. I just tried to point out to my colleagues that it was a little bit ridiculous for us to be talking about the number of molecules in the terms that were introduced in the 17th century. I mean, Avogadro pointed out something very interesting in the 17th century, which was that the number of molecules in a particular volume of gas at standard, at the pressure of sea level and the temperature of like 25 degrees centigrade was some constant, and it didn't matter what the molecules were. It was later determined that that number was 6.023 times 10 to the 23rd power. Now, what that is, it's a number that's much greater than the number, really, of atoms in the galaxy. It's close. It's not quite, because, in fact, there are many, what moles they call that, there are many 22.4 liter spaces full of molecules in the galaxy. But biochemists do not any longer deal with huge numbers of molecules like that. We deal with one at a time sometimes, two at a time. And to use this currency of Avogadro's, well, Avogadro never intended it to be the currency that we would use in terms of determining quantity of molecules in the 20th century. He didn't really know what was going to happen by now. But it would be like if we were buying gasoline based on, say, the fraction of the gross national product that a gallon of gasoline represented, it would be hard to get accurate change. And a lot of times, if people just use the numbers automatically, like scientists a lot of times do when they're dealing with huge numbers like that, you make gross mistakes. You might suddenly get change back for $1 million or something when you'd given the guy a 10 if you were dealing with fractional parts of the gross national product. So I did it at a meeting, and a lot of people approached me afterwards and said, you know what, that's a good idea. It's like sometimes the simplest little things. And I said, we're using 17th century nomenclature here to talk about something that's like three centuries later. And maybe we ought to change it. Now, it wasn't just for fun. I said, if you want to understand something, you want to have your nomenclature or the way you talk about it to be as simple as possible. If you start using really huge words to talk about something really simple, you yourself get confused. And the people you're talking to get confused. It's harder to see the truth or the falsity of something, if the words that you're using to talk about it actually obscure the issue rather than illuminate it. And that was the point of that chapter. I was trying to bring that up because I think in modern scientific sort of discussions that have to do with socially relevant scientific issues, a lot of scientists try to use the most obscuring words they can, and it obscures two things. It obscures the issue, and a lot of times it obscures their ignorance, which may be the reason that they do it.
During what time did you feel that you had it? When did you know that this testing problem was soluble?
The polymerase chain reaction would work?
Yes.
Well, the night that I conceived of it, I was driving up to Mendocino, California from Berkeley, and it was late, and I was thinking about things that I had been working on, and I saw I really wasn't looking for a process that would do something so spectacular as the PCR did. I was looking for something a lot more mundane, but in the process of that, I had sort of arranged my little molecular tinker toys, so to speak, on my molecular tinker toy screen in front of my face between me and the highway while I was driving along with something to do with my hands and nothing else to do with my mind but think about those things. I had arranged them into this format that any molecular biologist these days would say, that's PCR. Well, at the time, I didn't understand what PCR was, but I had this picture in my mind of two pieces of single-stranded DNA attached in a certain way to a double-stranded piece, and it occurred to me that if I didn't do what I was thinking about doing, but did something a little different, which was to heat and cool and heat and cool and heat and cool over and over again, that what would happen would be that the sequence I was trying to examine with these two short pieces of DNA would copy itself over and over again. Every time I heated it and cooled it, it would copy it. And then all the copies would copy themselves, and all the copies of those would copy themselves. And that's where you would get to the 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 exponential kind of process that would produce billions, really, if you wanted, copies of a short piece of DNA. That was the...
What year was that?
That was Friday night, sometime in May in 1983. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know it was sometime in May because the California Buckeyes were in bloom. And because when I came up with the idea, I went back to, I immediately thought, I said, my God, this will make me famous. In fact, if this works, I'll get a Nobel Prize for it. And I tried to wake up my girlfriend, who was the only other biochemist in Mendocino County that night, or the only one I knew about, to see if she could figure out why it wouldn't work, because I couldn't figure out why it wouldn't work. And I felt like, if it does work, somebody will be doing it already, and I'd have heard of it. In fact, I'd be doing it. So there must be something wrong with my logic there. But I wrote it down in lots of different ways, and I wrote it, in fact, finally, on every piece of paper in my house. I went finally to my little cabin in Mendocino and used up all the paper, started, you know, crayons, pencils, whatever, because I couldn't figure out why it wouldn't work. It seemed to me like it must work, and yet I knew that if it did, it would be there already. Somebody would have been doing it. That was back before I realized that some of the most simple things are never really seen. The easiest stuff, a lot of times, is just lurking there underneath all the details, and nobody has ever noticed it.
Our guest is Dr. Carrie Mullis, the author of Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, published by Pantheon. I'm Robert Knight, and this is Earthwatch. And 10 years from that time, you would receive the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. I'd just like to help establish for our audience, in between the proliferation of uses for this test, which multiplied almost the same way those molecules did. I once interviewed a director of the Fish and Wildlife Service. One of the things that they are able to do is combat rare or protected species poaching and delivery. They're able, one of the things that he boasted was being able to tell exactly which animal a seized piece of evidence may have come from. Is that one of the uses of the PCR test?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's not just for humans.
No, no. Yeah, you can track. You can figure out where if you've got the reference sample, for instance, of a particular pod of whales or something, you could tell whether somebody was selling meat from that particular pod. You could certainly tell from particular species without even having a reference sample from a particular pod. But you could get down even closer than that. I mean, you can tell. Basically, every animal, every plant on Earth has basically got a serial number, and that is its DNA code. I mean, its sequence of DNA is long enough to where there's plenty of numbers in there, there's plenty enough numbers in there to define every single individual specifically, if you're willing to go to the effort of sequencing it. And with PCR, you can do that.
What if I had a stain on my tie?
Yeah.
Would you be able to tell who put it there?
You don't have a tie on right now, but if you did...
well,
I could tell you...
Suppose I did have a blue dress.
If it was a stain, if it was a blue dress, and you had a stain there that included some DNA, I could tell you whose DNA it was. I couldn't tell you whether it came out of his mouth or some other organ, and I couldn't tell you whether it got rubbed off from his hands, even, or whether he coughed in an elevator with you and it got there. But I could tell you had been close enough to that person to have the DNA transported to you. That's all I could tell you.
What are some of the most interesting applications of PCR that you look at around the world?
I think the very most interesting one that might be of interest to, like, someone who is not themselves a molecular biologist would be that we can now trace our heritage right on back, you know, to unicellular animals in a very, very a way that's much more specific and much more believable than the way that the evolutionists have been able to deal with up to now, where they just look at structures of things and they say, well, this animal is related to this one by 10 million years of evolution because this particular part of its beak has changed or this particular part of its claw. Now we can have a much more very quantitative and believable picture of how we came to be. And I, for one, am very interested in that, of seeing, like, well, how did it happen that one cell animals grew into multicellular animals that grew into things like us, and where is that likely to go? It's interesting to see that whole thing, and being able to look back at fossils, also being able to look at every single form of life on the Earth today in terms of who's related to who and exactly how far was it since we were both the same thing. It's very interesting. Now that, I think, in terms of general interest, is one of the most interesting things about it. Not that we can just identify each other and stuff like that, but that we can see what the relationships between us and other animals are. For molecular biology itself, what PCR has done is it's offered a mechanism whereby DNA can be manipulated, which is as powerful to molecular biology as, say, a screwdriver is to carpentry. It's like without which you would not want to do it. Right? It has become that way. And it was only, 10, 15 years ago that it appeared. But if you tried to take the PCR away from a molecular biologist today, he'd kill you. He'd say, I'm not going to be a molecular biologist without it, because it would be boring, it would take too long, and I would be unable to do all the things I like to do. It's turned out to be a really, really interesting tool, and it's been applied in as many ways, really, in fact, more ways than a screwdriver has to carpentry, because basically a screwdriver is just a way to screw a screw into something. You can hold two things together with a screw, but PCR has actually enabled an enormous variety of stuff. Things like, there's all these things like sexual PCR, which is one of my most favorite ones, where you can take two or three or four different species of the same organism and you can mix their genes together in forms the same exact way that sexual reproduction and what they call recombination mixes the genes of the two parents together and produces a totally unique kid that's not either one of them, but it encompasses some of the properties of each. And every now and then, out of that process, you get a real monster, or either you get a real wonderful little kid. And like, you can do that same thing on a molecular level with PCR.
One of the ways that you are is somewhat un... Well, I don't know what the correct word would be. I almost called you unorthodox. And yet, in some of your controversial ways, you are merely scientific. I refer, for instance, to your challenge of the assertion that the acquired immune deficiency syndrome is inextricably and uniquely linked with HIV. You've challenged some of the general consensus on that. Why don't you explain how you disagree with the conventional word that is being spread today?
Okay. I think that's a fair question. I think starting with the definition of orthodox and whether I'm orthodox or not, if you talk about like the Orthodox Russian Church or something like that, you're talking about like something's going on maybe, and are you still the same as the way it was done in the 17th century or something like that? That's orthodox, right? I'm orthodox in my scientific viewpoints in that I'm willing to do my science and to expect other people to do theirs according to the rules that were very simply laid down in the 17th century and which led to the fact that people here in the 20th century are capable of having possessions due to science that are things kings would have gone to war to get 300 years ago. We have those kind of things now. We have those things because scientists were willing to follow certain rules that were laid down in the 17th century, and those were really simple. It says, if you have something that you want to prove to me, a skeptic, you have to come up with evidence that you can put on a screen, or either, back then it was put on a stage, show it to me. Show it to me in a way that if I look at it carefully, and if I'm willing to study what it is that you're trying to show to me, then I see it. Then I will be convinced, as are you, of the validity of the concept that it demonstrates. Things like gravity were demonstrated that way, with little balls rolling down inclined planes. Anybody could look at them. Anybody could say, I see the same thing there as Isaac Newton sees. And the way he's explained it makes sense to me. Now that I've seen it, I believe it. I accept it. That's the way science has been done for 300 years. Now, when it comes to the business of whether or not HIV causes AIDS, there's been a totally different set of standards applied to how you convince somebody that something is true or not. And the standard that has been applied there has not been really well defined. You don't have to show anybody. It's like if somebody announces in a press conference, like in this case it was Bob Gallo, announced in a press conference in 1984 that he thought that HIV was the cause of AIDS. And the reason he thought it was just because some guy in France named Luc Montagnier had isolated that virus, which no one had ever seen before, from an AIDS patient, or somebody who became an AIDS patient later, somebody who finally died from AIDS. But that's all he had, really. But he announced it on television before he had ever talked to his colleagues and tried to defend his hypothesis in front of them. But at the same time, he got, because he was a friend of someone named Margaret Heckler, who was the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare at the time in the United States, he suddenly got about $1 billion a year to distribute among anybody who, accepting that hypothesis, would start doing experiments to prove it. Now, that's just exactly asked backwards the way it's supposed to work. Because what that did was it created a huge bureaucracy of scientifically inclined people who were not willing to go by the rules, but who were willing year after year to collect money from the government to do so-called research into proving that HIV caused AIDS. Now, They should have been trying to figure out what caused AIDS. There was no good reason why somebody shouldn't have been doing that. AIDS shouldn't have been the focus of the national health care scientific movement, because AIDS was really a very minor disease compared to things like heart disease and cancer. It shouldn't have been the focus. It became the focus probably because Ronald Reagan was tired of seeing a bunch of homosexuals picketing the White House. And he said to Margaret Heckler one day, "Margaret, don't we have some kind of building down there in Bethesda or somewhere where they do research on this kind of thing?" And she said, "Yes, sir, we do. It's called the National Institutes of Health." And he probably said, "Well, Margaret, you go down there and you tell them to cure this disease, because I'm tired. Every time I come to work, I have to walk through all these signs, and I'm getting tired of it," or something like that. It's probably what happened. And that sounds crazy, but that's probably what happened. And then a whole bunch of people given money to do something will continue to do it as long as you keep giving them money to do it. And there are a lot of researchers in the world now. And it's about, at this point, it's probably about a $20 billion a year business, the AIDS business. Most of it based on the idea that the disease is caused by a virus that itself may not even exist. And that has certainly never been shown in a way that an interested skeptic could be convinced. I mean, that's the whole point of scientific debate, is that if anybody disagrees and they're willing to study all the documents, all the notation, all everything, try to figure out what it is the person who's trying to convince them is convinced of. If someone who's a skeptic is willing to go to the trouble of looking at your experiments, and you cannot, with your experiments, prove to that skeptic that your conclusions from your experiments are correct, then you don't have science anymore. You've got religion. And religion, remember, did not get us anything good. It promises something later, but it doesn't ever bring us anything but wars and trouble. Science has brought us television and stuff that, like I said earlier, kings 300 years ago would have gone to war with each other to have. And we've got it from science. The kind of thing that's going on with HIV and AIDS isn't science. And I've tried to demonstrate that in lots of talks. And sometimes I've been actually barred from giving the talks. One time I was even, as I went in my book, I described this. Once I was even paid $6,000 not to talk, because there's a lot of people that don't want to hear the possibility that HIV doesn't cause AIDS. Well, those people are not real scientists. Because nothing excites you more, if you're a real scientist, than someone who doubts your conclusions. Because that is the time when you get to look at them carefully yourself and try to prove to that person that your experiments are correct and that they should convince anybody. And if they don't, you should keep talking to those people that they don't convince.
It's astonishing. In your book, Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, from Pantheon Press, Dr. Carrie Mullis, a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, you state the very simple fact that you could not find one citation in all of the medical and scientific literature unambiguously stating that HIV is a causative factor in AIDS. You also tell about...
No, wait, I didn't even go that far. Unambiguous would be asking a lot. I just said I could not find a single paper or a collection of papers or a review of such papers which would lead one to the conclusion that HIV was the probable cause of AIDS. And there's a big difference between unambiguous and probable.
You also tell the remarkable encounter that you had with the Glaxo Corporation, where you were paid to not speak. One of the impressions I have of science and industry is that the purpose of a system is what it does. And apropos of your experience, I guess the system works.
They didn't shut me up. They just prevented me from talking at that particular meeting, and I made it cost them $6,000 by threatening them. Because they had invited me to that meeting, and then very near the meeting, they decided, they had heard somebody at Glaxo who had taken over Burroughs Wellcome Mine and heard me in London talking about the subject that I was going to talk about at their meeting called Medicine on the Frontiers of Science or something like that. And he realized this guy is talking about something that would be harmful to our $2 billion a year profit that we're making off of AZT. Why should we pay him to come here and give that lecture? And who the hell invited him? And so the guy that invited me actually, I believe, left the company, maybe intentionally or because of them, but I wrote them a letter and said, I'm sorry that you cannot accommodate me at this meeting anymore, but I've already made plans to be on the East Coast and so forth, and I made a lot of lawyer kind of statements in there that said, basically, you send me every penny that you were going to have to pay to have me come over there in the first place, and then I won't come. And you better tell those people at the meeting that it wasn't because I decided not to come, because I don't want to be in the, I don't want to get known as somebody who cancels appointments at the last minute. And this is a, it's, I could quote my letters to them in that book, and I did. I couldn't quote their letters to me. I discovered from the lawyers at Pantheon that when you get a letter from somebody, you own the paper, but you don't own the words. So you can't just take a letter that somebody wrote you and put it in a book. So I had to just paraphrase the letters to me, but I did in that chapter. I thought it was a funny chapter, but it was a serious subject. Because when you start squashing scientific debate, you're not a scientist.
That particular chapter is indeed hilarious, while at the same time it's no joke. There are social consequences that people who are diagnosed as having the HIV virus endure because of the perhaps incompletely informed association of it with AIDS. It has social consequences for some people.
Terrible ones.
And it may not even be a bad thing, I believe. Is that...
I know a lot of people that have had HIV diagnosis for a long time, and they have no problems. 10, 20 years. I mean, it's like, not 20. I know people that have had it for at least 12 years that have had HIV, a diagnosis of HIV positive for at least 12 years. They've never shown any symptoms. They've also never taken any drugs that would kill them in 4 years, like AZT. They've never panicked because for some reason they had this feeling that they had fortunately made contacts with the right people who said, you know what, we don't really know that that is exactly associated with AIDS. We don't know that that is actually important at all. We don't know that that's not a harmless retrovirus like the 100,000 retroviral genomes that we have coded in our own genome. We've been dealing with retroviruses our entire, probably since we were mammals, maybe before that. But their skeletons are in our genome, and their skeletons are not always inactive either. Sometimes one of them expresses itself, and actually we have an active retroviral, what you might call an infection, except it comes from your own genome. So it's the expression of retroviral proteins in your own genome for various purposes. We don't know what those purposes are. It doesn't mean that they're malevolent. I mean, we've got enough of that in our genome. That's like 100,000 copies of a 9,000 base pair sequence. What's that? It's like it's millions and millions of base pairs. It's probably a tenth of a percent. It's probably a percent of our whole genome is made out of what seems to be retroviral sequences, like this thing they call HIV. It's different from having an extraneous one in you, granted, but it means that we've been exposed to them enough so that they've integrated themselves into our genome over the last billion years at least. And there's no reason to think that just because you find a retrovirus in somebody that's sick, that's what caused the disease. It's totally ridiculous.
Were it not for this detour of the HIV-AIDS association without documentation, how would you advise one better to be researching the disease?
Well, you know, before the detour, which was about 1984 when Gallo jumped into it, The people that were actually studying the disease had decided it was probably multifactorial, meaning there were many causes for it. My own personal feelings, and personal feelings really have no place in science except to lead you to experiments. My own personal feelings about it was that the people who were coming down with AIDS had a lot of serious health problems caused by their neglect of their health, like the failure to follow their grandmother's simple rules about the fact that you need to eat a decent, balanced diet. You need to sleep at least once every night. I had a couple, three guys lived beside me in Berkeley, were friends of mine, and they were gay. And we played poker sometimes in front of the house about in the early 80s. We had a nice big tree and a little card table. And then the bathhouses opened up in San Francisco. And they, in fact, this was like, this was actually earlier than the 80s. This was, sometimes I forget how old I am. This is back in the 70s. And they started going over to these bathhouses, and they were, I'd hear stories about how much fun it was, and I noticed they were all getting, after, you know, about 6 or 7 months, they weren't getting much sleep, and they weren't getting much food, and they were looking pale, and they were getting all kinds of diseases. They were always a good bellwether, sort of, for whether a new flu was going to come through town or anything like that. They were definitely out there on the edge of health, and they were looking paler, and I recognized it because I'd known these guys for a couple of years, and I stopped seeing them in the afternoon. So as soon as they got off work, bang, they were over to San Francisco, and I thought, well, if they had heterosexual bathhouses in Berkeley, I'd be going there too. But they didn't, and I might be going there almost compulsively. So I was saved by the fact that the women weren't as interested in doing that kind of stuff as the men were. The gay community was sort of a homogeneous community. They had the same kinds of ideas about, you know, what was appropriate behavior and what wasn't. And so that's why they could have the pleasures of those bathhouses, but they also had to suffer the consequences. And I think the consequences of a life that was led, like, where you stopped sleeping and you stopped eating, we're going to be sort of multiple. There's going to be a lot of things happening to you. And if you started getting something like pneumocystis carinii and pneumonia, you shouldn't be so shocked. If you'd already lost about 10 or 20 pounds and you were really pale and you'd had the flu 4 times, when most of your friends, other than the people that have been going over there, had only had it, say, once in the last 2 years. I mean, it's just like they were not healthy middle-aged or young men who suddenly came down with a strange disease. They were people who had generally destroyed their health by just doing things that their grandmother would have told them, don't do that, right? And they knew it. They knew that. You know that. When you go without sleep for a couple of days, you start bumping into things. You start getting, no matter what kind of drugs you're taking to keep you awake at work, you still are not right. There's something wrong. You can't just keep on doing that kind of stuff. And yet the driving force for them to continue to do it was this very strong driving force, which is like our sexual drive, which has always been a fairly benign thing on the planet, although it's caused people trouble. But it was that sort of thing. And it was a changing period where everybody said, we can do whatever we care to do. None of the old rules apply. And some of the old rules actually did apply. And that was the ones associated with getting a couple of good meals every day and sleeping at night, that kind of stuff. And don't take meth every single day in extreme doses to stay up at work.
Avoid hot, steamy, moldy places?
Yeah, and hot, steaming. Well, I don't know about hot, steamy, moldy places, but you put that on top of it and you say, I'm gonna really hurt my health by not eating and not sleeping, and then I'm going to associate myself with a whole bunch of people who are doing the same thing as me, and we're going to be doing it in a hot, dark, warm, like wet environment where anything that anybody's got is going to spread. That would be the very best way to collect every disease on the whole planet.
Our audience would consider me remiss if I did not ask you, if there are researchers you're aware of who are doing what you consider interesting or scientific work in a multi-factor, multivariate analysis of the AIDS phenomenon.
There were until Tony Fauci and Bob Gallo sort of took over the funding. That was in about 1984. That was when it was announced that they had the cause ready, and it was HIV, and they had the government funding. Fauci was the head of the National Institute for Allergic and Infectious Diseases or something like that. And still, I think he's now not that anymore. I think they got rid of him. But he and Bob Gallo pretty much decided who would get funds to do research and who would not. And if you said anything contrary to the idea that HIV was the cause, the single cause of AIDS and the inevitable cause of death, if you ever got it, then you could not get any money from the federal government for doing AIDS research. There were a few minor exceptions. There was one guy, I think, that was working for like the armed forces where they weren't under the same hierarchy. And he started proposing other things. But the people who had been working in the field prior to that, who had pretty much tentatively concluded, and nobody had any, I mean, like the editor of the Journal of AIDS Research had concluded himself in a couple of editorials that AIDS was a multifactorial disease. It was caused by a lot of things. It wasn't actually a disease in the sense of an infectious disease. It was just a condition that would happen given certain things, given certain kinds of behavior. You would end up getting this kind of a problem, like if stopping to eat, for instance. And that guy, his name was Joseph Sonnabend, and he was replaced as the editor of that journal, and the name of the journal was actually changed from Journal of AIDS Research to Journal of HIV and AIDS Research or something like that. They really just took the whole field, and these people, a lot of them were frustrated researchers at the National Cancer Institute who had not been able to show a viral cause for cancer. They'd been trying for 10 years. And they'd been writing grants every year, getting weaker and weaker because the evidence that cancer was caused by a virus was getting less and it was just harder and harder to convince anybody that viruses caused cancer because no one had ever come up with one, with the exception of one man, Bob Gallo, who had come up with some one stupid paper where he noted the connection between infection between this HTLV-1, he called it, and some weird cancer that people on two little islands in the south of Japan got. And he took that as proof that those viruses caused that cancer without going around the rest of the world looking for those viruses and seeing if they caused that cancer anywhere else. And as soon as anybody did, they discovered, of course, it didn't. It was another case of like what was the word you used? It was circumstantial evidence. That's what it was. And you just can't count on that. You can use that as a lead. You know, circumstance, nothing wrong with circumstantial evidence, but then you've got to come in and show beyond that that there's much better evidence than just circumstantial. And nobody did that. Nobody. There is not a single person, and this we get back to this business that you mentioned earlier and that I mentioned in my book. If you wanted, for instance, if it turns out that AIDS is caused by HIV, and that by knowing that, somebody cures AIDS, who do you give the Nobel Prize to for finding out that HIV caused AIDS? Where are the papers? Who would you go back to? Because I have asked every single AIDS researcher that I've ever met, and that's a lot of them, because I used to go to all their meetings because they use PCR to detect HIV. And I've asked every single one of them, every time I would hear a talk after it, I'd go up afterwards and very quietly, not making a fuss or anything, because nobody knew that I had this feeling that they were all a bunch of assholes at the time. But I'd say, I have a problem. I'm writing a grant request, and this was a true problem I had, to the NIH, because I was working in this company where we were doing this. I was developing tests for HIV in the blood supply. I said, I would like to be able to quote a reference for the statement, HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. That's a good way to start the grant request, because I'm trying to convince these people to give us another $200,000 to work on trying to find out if there's HIV in the blood supply. So I think I ought to have a reason. So I had written the sentence before. This is how I got into the thing in the first place. I'd already written the sentence. I figured there was evidence, or they wouldn't be saying there was evidence, right? So I wrote, HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. And then I went around the company I was working at, asking the virologist, what was the appropriate reference to quote to support that notion? Right? Who do I put a little one there and then go down to the bottom and say, here's where that's shown in the literature. And nobody, the first person I went to said, you don't need to quote that. Everybody knows that. And I said, well, I don't. I don't know how where it came from, so I need to quote it. I don't want somebody to look at me later and say, how the hell did you know that? Right? That's not scientific anyhow. And I wanted to know at that point. I said, well, where did it come from? And the more I looked, the more frustrated I got, and I couldn't find it. And I went to, like, by then we have, like, electronic searching of the literature, but the very best way is just to go to all the meetings where AIDS researchers are and ask them one at a time, say, where was it that you became convinced, how did you become convinced that HIV is the probable, and I emphasize the word probable, cause of AIDS? What paper did you read that told you that, you know? And nobody came up with anything. Now, there's the New York Times article, which is not usually considered a scientific journal, and there was a televised news conference in which Gallo said, sir, we have found the cause of AIDS, the probable cause, I believe he said.
Proof by assertion.
Yes, proof by assertion. Not proof by, like, here are the experiments that we did, and you can do them yourself in your own lab and reproduce this for yourself if you don't believe it. But here's what we did, and here's what we concluded. There is not anything like that in the entire scientific literature concerning the probable cause of AIDS. And yet, hundreds of thousands of people are taking a poisonous drug that costs a lot of money to cure their AIDS on the assumption that their AIDS is caused by HIV. And even though their HIV sometimes disappears, and they're told that they're getting well, and they feel like it for a while, it still doesn't work. They don't get well. After a while, the so-called placebo effect wears off, and they start getting sick again. I say it happened with AZT. It's happened with the protease inhibitors. The same thing. The disease has not been cured based on the hypothesis that HIV causes it. It's been 12 or 13 years now. It's time for a new hypothesis. It's time for somebody else to come in there and say, "Wait a minute, you guys, let's clean out this whole cesspool of people who are so convinced that HIV causes AIDS that they're not even willing to look for a reference that would say it does or it doesn't. Not willing to question each other's data. Not willing to really look into it with the idea in mind that there might be something wrong with it. And when something like that, a simple little 9,600 base pair organism, that's what they think that is, goes for 12 years in the face of the most advanced medical technology that's ever been on the planet, probably, and evades it. There's good reason just on the basis of that to say, hey, maybe we're on the wrong trail. You know?
You remind me of the story of Nasruddin, who was found one day looking through his front yard. A student came up and said, what are you doing? I'm looking for my keys. Do you have any idea where you lost them? He said, well, sure. I lost them in my kitchen. But, Master, why are you searching out here in the front yard? Well, the light's so much better. The funding is so
yes,
much better.
Yes, the funding is so much better.
We're speaking with Dr. Kerry Mullis, the author of Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, and it's published by Pantheon. On the cover is a picture of a surfer dude, man. It's he is living presently in California. However, myself, I'm Robert Knight. This is Earthwatch, and I was born in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, and I was proud to see someone of your accomplishment being born just down the road at Lenore.
Lenore, yeah.
North Carolina.
No, North Wilkesboro.
How have
there's a lot of us climbed out of there, you know.
We don't do badly.
No. The Blue Ridge Mountains weren't all that bad for anybody.
Beautiful place. One of the things that we revere in the way that Tar Heels are reared is that we do take the advice of our grandmamas, of our grandparents. And one of the things that mine did was she cooked really good food for me. She didn't believe in any of that diet stuff that you eat twice as much of, because probably you're not getting enough nutrition from it. And one of the chapters in your book, one that just made my heart fly with joy, is chapter 16, The Age of Nutritional Obsession. What's your feeling? What's your take? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think what I mean by that is just kind of what it says. We've gotten into a, and I'm not really, I think it started when, like, some biochemists really did find out some real things about certain kind of vitamins that we really needed to have. Like, for instance, in the South, in the early part of this century, there was a disease. Let's see, what was its name? It was pellagra. And it was thought to be an infectious disease. And the federal government set up a research station down in South Carolina somewhere, I think it was in Charleston, to study it. It turned out it was basically a disease that poor farmers had. And it was because, it turned out, after about 20 years of treating it as an infectious disease and going so far as to taking children out of a home where pellagra was common when they were born and putting them into an orphanage where they seemed to not get pellagra, which convinced a lot of people that it was infectious, it turned out that it was the fact that everybody was eating corn instead of wheat, and they weren't getting any vitamin B6, I think it was. It's one of the B vitamins. It just doesn't happen to be in corn, and it does happen to be in wheat. And once you start eating brown bread again, you're okay. Same thing happened with scurvy. The British Navy thought it was an infectious disease, and they used to throw people overboard when they first came down with it instead of giving them limes. And they finally discovered that scurvy was the lack of ascorbic acid or vitamin C, and all they had to do is carry a big barrel of limes with them. There are some infectious diseases for sure, but we didn't have any AIDS in North Carolina. We didn't have a lot of hot tubs either, but we did eat really good, and we usually got a few hours of sleep every night.
Now, there are many people, including those who listen to Earthwatch, who are very, almost puritanical in the foods they choose and the way that they approach eating food. And if I may just revert to some down-home wisdom, I don't know anybody eating diet food who ain't fat.
No, I think, well, I've got off the subject there, as you asked. It is the age of nutritional obsession there, I don't know if I say that directly in there, but I think that being obsessed by what you eat, by being obsessed by anything, is really not the best possible human posture toward it. You know, a little healthy skepticism towards almost everything, especially towards things that you know people are making money off of. You know, we've learned how to be skeptical of our politicians. We've learned how to be skeptical of the commercials that we see on television. We need to be skeptical also about our dietitian people, our nutritionists, and people say you need to have some of this, and you have to need some of this, and you need to take a handful of pills every day, and then you have to eat this kind of food that won't do this to you, or this kind of food that won't do that to you. I mean, I have always had a sort of a policy of eating whatever I thought tastes good when I was hungry, and scratching whenever I itched, and running when something was after me, you know. And not running just for the heck of it to lose weight, but running when something was... When I had a reason to run, I run. It's not necessarily good for you to run. It's not necessarily good for you to diet. It's just we've gotten into this stage of whatever the 20th century is coming to an end being, where we're obsessed with our nutrition, we're obsessed with all kinds of habits, we've got to lift weights in order to keep our arms thin or whatever. I think there's nothing wrong with a certain amount of exercise. I go surfing every morning when I can, and I hang out in cold water, which I think actually burns up a lot of fat. But I just eat when I'm hungry, you know, and I scratch when I itch. And I just don't really let somebody tell me what I need. I listen basically to my body, which I think is about as wise as my grandmother was.
One of the things you say explicitly in the book, Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, is don't trouble yourself with details that do not matter for survival.
I did say that, yeah. I think that's details that you don't understand at all. particularly. Details that somebody else who's got a dollar to make off of you, like listening to those details. Those things are not really helpful for you. Should be. That's where I was talking about being obsessed, is letting little details that you don't know anything about. Most people don't know anything really about carbohydrates. Most people wouldn't know a carbohydrate if there was some in their hand and there was some protein in their other hand. They say, which one's carbohydrate, which one's protein? They wouldn't know. They can read labels and stuff that people write, and they can say, well, this nutritionist says this about that, and I should have this much of that and this much of that. And you can get really involved in the details. And I think it's like, you know, you fail to see the forest sometimes for the trees. You can starve yourself to death being worried that somebody's going to poison you. Kurt Gerdell did that in our century. And you can just do all kind of obsessive things if you get caught up in little, I don't know, details are only good if you really understand the context that they're in and what they're for.
One of the things that I'm finding interesting here is that the book, Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, is rife with unusual perspectives on subjects and issues. And as phenomenal as your PCR DNA testing invention may be, as fabulous as it is to be the recipient of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, I can't help but wondering if these accomplishments are a byproduct of the way that your mind works. If you're not smart because you got the prize, but because you're different, you got smart. I'm not expressing it precisely, but I think you know what I mean.
You know what? Let me tell you what dancing naked in the mind field means to me. And that might, I mean, I've always in my life refused, for whatever stubbornness or whatever, to clothe my mind, right? I don't put clothes on top of it and coats on top of it and things to protect it from knowing things. I'm always really devilishly, really curious about what really is going on. I do all kinds of things. I'm just a normal, I love to watch television, you know, but I try to look back behind the camera and say, what the hell is actually going on here? You know, what is this show about? Who's doing this show? And who are the people that their authorities are? If it's something that's supposed to inform you of something, commercials particularly, you know. I got upset about, I didn't get upset, but I got really curious about these commercials. They started putting on, the drug companies started putting on these commercials that always had this theme of it. I'm a researcher in the pharmaceutical industry, and I don't want to make drugs for my grandchildren. I want to make drugs for people who need them right now. You know, and I started looking at those things, and I said, now, why in hell are they putting on those commercials? That's a whole bunch of pharmaceutical companies are putting money into this. Why? I thought maybe they're trying to influence future juries in trials that would have to do with the drug company putting out a drug that had some adverse effects and caused some deaths or whatever, and they got sued. Maybe that's what it is. Why else would they be doing that, you know? And I don't know any, I mean, that's the kind of thing I mean about, like, not listening to every, not thinking that everything you see or hear is what it actually appears to be, and knowing that everything's there because somebody wants it to be there. Nobody's really on your side here, not even me. I'm trying to sell you a book, right? But I don't like being deceitful. I've never been very good at it because I have such a poor memory that if I ever lie to somebody about something, I end up getting in trouble because I can't remember what I told them. So that's my reason. That's my selfish reason for being honest.
That's why you can never be president. You need to have a good memory.
Either that or a good secretary.
Well, Dr. Kerry Mullis, you've been listening to an interview with the Nobel Prize-winning chemistry inventor of the PCR DNA test, Dr. Kerry Mullis. I'm Robert Knight. This is Earthwatch. We may have time for some phone calls at area code 212-209-2900 and maybe even a few glimpses at the Miliani Day March.
are tuned to Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, and you're on the air.
All praises due to Allah. This is Monty.
How are you?
My brother, the brother that's speaking, that talked about the DNA and everything, he is right on top of Monty's vibes. I do not eat anything unless I'm hungry, and I do not follow behind people. This brother is right on top of the real deal. And it's amazing. I'm sitting here with a smile on my face. You understand? He is really, and 'cause life is really simple. It's people that makes it complex. Because, like he said, the solution was right in front of him, but it was so simple he couldn't see it. And that's the way life is. And I'm glad that you have him on, my brother. You understand? And he is right on the money as far as eating what makes you feel good and not listening to these popcorn people about what is good and what is. My grandmother lived to be 90 and she ate everything in God's green earth. You understand? And she didn't know nothing about anything.
Same with mine. And she's still moving around more than me.
There you go. You understand? And like I said, Monty eats whatever makes him feel good and whatever tastes good to him. And he does whatever makes him feel good. And if it's time to run, I run. You understand? And if it's time to stand and fight, that's just what I do. I love what the doctor's doing and keep on keeping on and walk on the right side of the street.
Hey, you know what? Makes me think natural living has very little to do with natural living.
There you go. It's just being yourself. Be for real.
All right. Thank you, man.
Peace.
This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
I think I'm going to have to disagree a little. I'm not saying I disagree with the idea that, the AIDS thing has been solved. That I don't disagree, you know. I think Gary Noll has been arguing also about the same thing that this gentleman was. But this, what Monty was waxing this, I mean, you could see mushrooms and pick up a mushroom that's poisonous and eat it and not realize it's going to kill you. I mean, you might say...
Well, that's not what he was talking about, and you know it. He was talking about the obsessional approach to health, diet, and exercise, a joyless Puritan doctrinaire way of listening to marketers rather than listening to the body. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
Hello. I just want to say, this is Michael Elmer. I just want to touch on something Carrie said that I think is real important. Is that the psychological impact of being told someone is HIV positive often is enough to cause them to get physically ill. And in some cases, might even kill them.
That's a point that I tried to infer in saying that the simple diagnosis of HIV does have a profound impact on people, particularly in not understanding its non-necessary linkage with AIDS.
Additionally, I think another factor is that T cells migrate under stress conditions. They leave the bloodstream and go to the skin.
Which is the most brilliant part of what Dr. Mullis was saying. He said that the appropriate approach to research on the subject is in the realm of multi-factor analysis. And the reason I thought it important and timely to present this interview is because just today, a protest was announced against one of them silly movies, one of them silly-ass girl movies. It's called, I think, House Della Got Her Groove Back.
Yes.
And it comes from the same kind of genre as Waitin' to Exhale and so on. And the reason the Haitian community is protesting that film is because there is a gratuitous slur against Caribbean people in it, including Haitians, who have already been stung by the FBI with the false characterization of Haitians as being being most likely to have AIDS. And in the movie, there's a line in which one of the sisters is talking to another sister and says, a line to the effect that, well, if you're getting down with that Jamaican boy, I hope you're using a condom because, you know, them people have a history of AIDS. And what is relevant to that is that Dr. Mullis was saying that AIDS may well be the breakdown that occurs when a complex series of stress factors in the body and challenges to the body and the mind and its interactions result in what would later come to be diagnosed as AIDS.
I fully appreciate
so,
that.
Therefore, why that's relevant to Haitians is this. My God, can you think of a nation on earth where the people have historically been under more stress, more poverty, more disease, more lack of sanitation, more multinational corporate exploitation, death squads? There is a consistency, I think, to the way that he's saying the issue needs to be approached.
I've always thought it should be approached as a political, social issue rather than a scientific challenge. I think if we address the underlying health risks of the various groups of people who develop AIDS, we'll see exactly who's getting sick and why, and that will definitely point to a multifactorial. What I was trying to point out is the hallmark of AIDS is this notion that a virus kills T cells. But however, when a person is told they're HIV positive, they go into a fight-or-flight syndrome, and their T cells migrate from their blood to the skin, which means that it's predictable. Now, it's been now demonstrated these T cell counts do not reflect states of health. There are people with very low T cell counts who are remarkably healthy, and there are people with very healthy T cell ranges developing AIDS-indicated diseases. So the whole context of this monstrous virus killing T cells becomes nonsense.
Well, thank you for your call and for your comment. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. This is Mishindo. I hope I say this correctly. I do think we should be concerned with what we consume based on, as the doctor said, how we feel, but also based on the knowledge of I think man's a vegetarian beginnings. You know, as a species, I think we're herbivores. You know, like cows. And
how do you explain eye teeth?
How do you explain what?
I believe they're called the eye teeth, the sharp ones.
Well, I think that there are for tearing. I would think, but I don't think the rest of the system is designed the way carnivores' systems are designed, with the short colon, a heavier stronger acidic base in the stomach for digestion, and the fact that the teeth go forward and backward instead of around for grinding. Just considering things like that, because I think it's the eating to feel good that I think causes the a lot of the diseases that we have, like the heart disease, because I think meat and so forth tastes good to people.
I think that the major culinary threat is not meat necessarily. I think that there is at least an equal threat posed by industrial manufacture of food products and of and of temporarily truisms. How many people think that they're dieting or becoming healthier or slimmer by eating that indigestible industrial fat called margarine? People used to think that was healthier than butter. You know, we're talking about so many hormones used in the production of dairy products, RGBH. We're talking about the pesticides that are used in the growth of your vegetables.
That's true, I agree.
And no one of these things need individually be lethal, but the most lethal thing is the fear of life that comes from superstition about food that overcomes the feeling of the body. I am not asserting that people should be foolish and reckless in what they eat, but I'm also saying that people should never confuse dining with health.
Well, as you say, I'll agree, you know, with the way you put it. You know, I don't think it's any one thing, but I wanted to express a concern.
I think you made
for people to have a healthy concern for what goes in their body, one by finding out what process their food goes through before it gets to them, but also knowing their bodies.
Or as the temples always say, know thyself. I think you've made the
I
point
agree.
Very well.
Know thyself.
Thank you,
Robert. You have a great show.
All right.
All right, bye-bye.
Gosh, all the phones are lit. Time is short. And I would heartily recommend those who would like further specificity and detail on these and many other exciting and some humorous issues in the book that they do read Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, written by Carrie Mullis, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his invention of, as you heard, that ubiquitous test, the polymerase chain reaction DNA test. And this is one of the most fun books to read. It is not technically scary, although it is very precise and specific. I think you get a taste of it from talking to him. We are his first interview, and very proud to have done so. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
Yeah, Robert?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi, this is Bud Weiss. I've been pursuing you for years about all this.
Mm-hmm.
Sent you lots of material. I'm really so happy that you had Carrie on. He's on our board of directors, one of the board of directors of HEAL, and I just really thank you so much for having him on. It's a terrific show.
I'm glad to hear from you. Thank you.
Bye.
Earthwatch, you're on there.
Hi, Robert. Well, then, quickly, what I want to say is that, A, that was a good comment about margarine, and the other gentleman said, you know, how our foods process in relation, just as a general comment, and margarine, you know, hydrogenated oil is cooked to about 600 or 700 degrees. They throw a lot of solvents in, and it appears as margarine, and it appears in just about everything you can buy in a supermarket, and basically it blocks the cells from doing their job. It's an abomination, and it doesn't just appear in margarine. It's called hydrogenated oil.
Oh, those are the things in the little cans that go bitter.
Yeah, right. and the other quick question that I would like to ask your guest, if he had been there, was one of the great abominations in terms of this AIDS business is the Western blot test. I don't know if you know this, but there are so many minor, you know, you can have a cold and it can show up that you have AIDS. You can eat various foods and it can show up as AIDS. But most seriously, this happens a lot in Africa. When people have tuberculosis shows up as positive for AIDS on the Western blot. So what they're doing is that they're letting millions of people die and not treating them for TB because they think they can't treat them for AIDS.
You're making a really thoughtful point here.
Yeah.
It also can add to prejudice because
you bet it
of
can.
The misdiagnosis, can it?
You bet it can. I think he's right. This is a multifactorial thing, and a lot of times it's just diseases that we know that are being confused as AIDS, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's all. Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Our listeners are quite wise tonight. You're on the air. Hello.
Good evening.
On the air.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize your guest had been recorded earlier, but I make the general point anyway that it concerns me a lot that I suppose science was never totally pure, you know, in the sense that somebody's isolated in a research lab and was allowed to do whatever he wanted. But it seems like more and more, you know, it's come under the thumb of corporate control, and I suppose they quash any kind of, there's probably a tendency to quash research that doesn't, you know, either generate profits for them or interferes with a profit line, like, unfortunately, the AIDS thing now is the profits from the AIDS drugs, like the gentleman just before pointed out, you know, if they're treating people in Africa for AIDS rather than TB, I wonder what the profit differential between an inexpensive treatment for TB and a probably much more expensive treatment for AIDS is. on that point. So even if people might suspect they're doing the wrong thing, it's, you know, the amount, the noise from all that money kind of drowns out their ability to hear their conscience talking to them.
Very point well made.
And other than that, I'm glad you had him on. It sounds like a heck of a book, and it sounds like he's right up there with Richard Feynman for clarity of thought.
Yes, I was very proud to be with him.
Thanks a lot.
Colin. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
Bobbitt.
Yes.
How are you? I want to wish you a happy birthday. You had your birthday.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm going to try to get that book. It's called Dancing.
Yes.
It's called Dancing in the Minefield?
It's called Dancing Naked.
Oh, naked.
In the Mind Field. And the title comes from his metaphor that wearing clothes, being conventional, is a way of shielding yourself from the truth that surrounds you. That's why he calls it Dancing Naked in the Mind Field.
Can I ask you a question?
And it's published by Pantheon, okay. By Kary, K-A, it's spelled K-A-R-Y.
Okay.
And his last name is Mullis, M-U-L-L-I-S, chemistry Nobel Prize winner.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you think Mayor Giuliani is lacking anything in his diet? Too much safer?
Too much paper, too much safer, howdy doody safer, be a puppet.
Yep.
Since you broached the subject, I'm developing some thoughts that may be expressed along with some sound from the event, which I covered for the station along with a great crew of people here. The Million Cop March, one of the things I think it's important to be said is that somebody needs to defend the police. Did Robert say that? Yeah. Because there has been a great brutality practiced against the New York City Police Department, which on a number of occasions, with the community sense that at one time, aside from a permanent racism that characterizes some of police operations, nevertheless, compared to many cities, New York City police used to be streetwise and tactical-wise in dealing with the expression of steam of groups of people. The police did not used to provoke assemblies in the way that was done on Saturday, September 5th at the Million Youth March. I have found under the Giuliani administration a Nazification of operations of the police. You see that in the persistent harassment that is taking place against black protest in New York City today. I think that the police, with that absurd helicopter buzzing, for a moment I felt like an Italian with those helicopters flying by and giving the finger to the crowd at rooftop level and then lower than rooftop level, as if somebody was trying to be Top Gun. That stunt was as dangerous as what those fool pilots of the United States Marines did in Italy when they were clowning around just like the police helicopters and cut a cable and killed 20 people who fell to their snowy deaths on a mountain from a gondola. Those helicopters, during their passes, came so low you could see every mechanical detail. What if they had messed up? It would have been Vic Morrow, Twilight Zone all over the place, decapitations and blood. And the crowd rightfully hated that because they had nowhere to run. That operation was the moral equivalent of shooting fish in a barrel. And that is not the nature or the soul of the professionals who are in the police department. There has been a great abuse committed against the police in this city, and that abuse was done by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. He is the greatest cop hater in New York today, by putting them in jeopardy. by transferring to them the resentment that people seeking their freedom have. Police do not rule by military force. They do not rule by the gun. They rule by trust. And for all of the corrupt and evil and venal individuals that may be among the police, for every one of those, there's a number more who might be assumed to try to do the job they took an oath to do. That trust has been destroyed by Mayor Giuliani and by his puppet, Howdy Doody Safer. People want to put it all on Khalid Muhammad, on Al-Id Muhammad. No. The attack on the community came from the police. But the attack on the police came from the mayor, not from the people. Just wanted to say that. I'm sure there's going to be a lot to talk about. Thank you for listening. You can be in touch by calling 209. I've been Robert Knight. Thank you also, Dr. Kerry Mullis, for an extraordinary interview and an extraordinary book. It's called Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, published by Pantheon Press. Take a look at it. See you next week and tomorrow. Not to walk alone. I was waiting for the good Samaritan, but waiting was hopeless. It was all in vain. The Ku Klux Klan, but you get all and die for. Them not let me go now. Oh no, one nigga, the less, the better the show. Dance, jump, black skin, and take your blow.
And that program was brought to you on recording. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, we are going to hear a segment of a previous New York Review of Science Fiction readings, a special event we had with Sky Book Media, and of course, first, a review of The Giver, reviewed for us by Daniel Parsons. Stay tuned. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There are a couple of interesting ironies that come with the new film The Giver if you know enough about the work of its director, Philip Noyce. Noyce's career is wide and diverse. He's best known probably for such gritty espionage films as Patriot Games, Clear and Present Danger, and The Quiet American. But within that resume are a couple of lesser-known and very excellent social dramas. Rabbit Proof Fence, a period piece set in 1931 Australia about three Aboriginal girls who escape from a training camp and try to find their way home, and Catch a Fire, a true story set in apartheid-era South Africa about a black man who becomes a terrorist after his mistreatment at the hands of the all-white police force. Both great films, both worth checking out. The smaller irony is that significant portions of The Giver were shot in South Africa, so clearly no hard feelings there. More interesting is that for a director who has frequently created compelling dramas about the struggle for racial equality, The Giver may be the whitest film of the year. I only came to this realization late in the film, but I am fairly certain that, save for a variety of quick flash montage sequences that show an Earth before a non-specific apocalypse sets the stage for this particular story, there is not one non-Caucasian face in the entire film. At the very least, that's certainly true among the main cast. And the thing is, not only do I feel that this is not accidental, at least not in the customary, whoops, we just forgot that there are talented black actors out there way that still happens too frequently in the film and TV industry. It actually follows through on Noyce's history with racially aware drama. In The Giver's post-apocalyptic world, true equality has been attained essentially by tamping down all differences and anything that essentially defines the human condition. Emotions are chemically excised, lying is outlawed, and an antiseptic adherence to precision in thought, word, and deed is imposed. Thus, the numbing uniformity of skin color, drabness underlined by large portions of the film being presented in black and white, which, as it is slowly revealed, is less a stylistic touch on Noyce's part and actually supposed to be the way the characters perceive their world. But the main character of The Giver, a teenager named Jonas, played by Brenton Thwaites, whom we last saw in a small role in Maleficent, is about to find out that this is not the only way of seeing the world. He's been assigned by his community to become a receiver, a walking repository of human history before the world reached
this dystopically paradisiacal turn. To do this, he's apprenticed to the Giver, played by Jeff Bridges, an aged recluse who lives outside the community and their restrictions in a book-lined redoubt, and who telepathically transfers the thoughts, feelings, triumphs, and atrocities of true humanity to his young charge. It's a dangerous process, not just because of the potential psychic damage that might be inflicted with the revelation of the true cost for complete equality, including some nasty little secrets about what happens to keep this community at its most efficient population, but also because the Giver may have plans for his apprentice that fall far outside his archival mandate. The Giver is based on a series of much-beloved YA books written by Lois Lowry. Their popularity is news to me. Sorry, I kind of stopped at A Wrinkle in Time. So even though I haven't read them, I am presuming that the wider canvas a novel-length tale can provide would help better set the conditions under which the Giver and Jonas could get away with the things they do within this tightly controlled society. And length may also explain the problems during the film's final act, during which Jonas undertakes a lone odyssey through a banned territory. In theory, this should be a point of self-discovery for the character, when all of the experiences he previously received telepathically are now made tangible. Noyce, who as noted before is no stranger to tales of people calling upon stores of untapped strength to fight soul-crushing societal injustices, applies his considerable talents to conveying this emotional journey, but it still feels somewhat curtailed, and the story feels a bit lopsided because of it. And despite those problems, this is still a beautifully told and emotionally rich parable of what it means to be human and what we lose when we fail to accept humanity in all its glories and flaws. It's a tall order to sum up such concepts in not quite 2 hours, and The Giver doesn't always stick the landing, but it hits often enough to make this a thrilling and, yeah, memorable experience. I'm Dan Persons. We are now archiving these reviews at mightymoviepodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please be sure to check out Cinefantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan. Now, that was actually like the first review I've heard of The Giver that made it sound interesting to me, but what can I say? This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program, Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. The Hugo Awards were held this past weekend. This is the fan-issued award that determines excellence in science fiction and fantasy. This is as opposed to the Nebulas, which is a peer award voted by members of the science fiction writers, science fiction and fantasy writers community, as opposed to the World Fantasy Award, which A, does more or less stick to fantasy, and B, is a juried award. So they're all different views. But the Hugo is probably the best known. And I have not made secret of the fact that I have very happily been involved in editing, doing the post-production, and hosting of late Lightspeed Magazine's podcast. And I wasn't even thinking about what was going on, other than I saw some posts from the people that I work with. They are out in L.A., Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure. And they had a table representing Skyboat Media, their production company. And all of a sudden, I start getting some emails